Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pod Friends. My name is Matt Scott. I am the host of Pod Friends, and I'm just so thankful to be here, so thankful that you're listening, and so thankful for this week's interview conversation with none other than, as you know, Wendell Holland, who is the winner of Survivor Ghost Island, who was on Survivor Winners at War. But there's so much more to Wendell beyond Survivor, including just his roles and his spot, his growing role in the HGTV world, his work with Beav Unlimited, his work on the Purple Pants podcast, and friendship with Bryce Isaiah, the one and only Purple Pants badass. And there's so much that we dove into in this conversation. I really don't want to talk too much because I want to give you the chance to dive in and hear from Wendell, but just want to give a big shout out to Wendell for making space to not only talk about his life growing up, talk about some of the things he's built and put together, his love of plants, but also just for just being so open. And he mentioned this in the interview, but like, this was a safe space for Wendell to kind of share his truth, talk about so many aspects of his life, talk about Black representation and his experiences with that, and navigating that, but also talking about his friendship with Bryce, an often unfortunately uncommon friendship that we see between a straight Black man and a queer Black man. And we get into that. And there are so many things that we touched on. I just want to give a massive shout out to everyone who submitted questions for Wendell. A big shout out to Megan the Librarian, to Stephanie, to Felipe, to Josh Green, to John John, to John L or John I can't tell which John I, so many other people. Thank you so much for just kind of responding with your questions. And I made sure to kind of work them in one way or the other, but just want to thank you all for your support in that way and sharing your questions for Wendell. And more broadly, I just want to thank you all for your support throughout this first season of Pod Friends. It's really been incredible. This is the season finale, as I've mentioned, and I think this is a really strong note to go out on. But I also just want to give a big shout out to the people who left some reviews here. There's one, and you know what? Maybe I won't read the reviews too closely just because I don't want to congratulate myself or the podcast or you don't need to do that. If you want to check out the reviews, that's great. But I definitely want to give just a big shout out to everyone who left a review because I've been reading all of them and they've kind of been causing me to tear up a little bit just seeing that this Pod Friends thing is something that resonates with you, especially because, you know, like a lot of us, you know, you never know if the thing that you'll create will resonate with people or if it will be a thing that they could like react to and respond to. And my favorite thing about Pod Friends has really been hearing from all of you, not only in terms of the reviews, but also in terms of just Twitter and social media and seeing the comments either tagging me at Matt Scott GW or the Pod Friends account at Hey Pod Friends or the guest, just with all the love. It's so amazing. And I'm glad that this community is really gravitating to that. But, you know, I also just want to give a couple plugs before diving in. I want to encourage folks to subscribe to the podcast. You could go to robhasawebsite.com/podfriendsfeed. That's robhasawebsite.com/podfriendsfeed. And I would encourage that because while this is the season finale of Pod Friends, there I'm manifesting it just like Wendell manifests some things in this interview. There will be more Pod Friends to come. Stay tuned for that. I'm sure that there will be more conversations like this, and I'm excited for you to check that out. So definitely subscribe, rate, and leave 5 stars and leave a review. I definitely want to know what you think. And I love the energy around this podcast. And again, I'm just so thankful, genuinely so thankful and energized by this and by all of you and by the conversation with Wendell. If you want to just suggest future Pod Friends guests, you could go to the link, one of the links in the bio, bit.ly/podfriendsnom. That's bit.ly/podfriendsnom as a nomination. And, you know, other than that, I would encourage folks to become patrons of RHAP. There are so many phenomenal aspects of being a patron of RHAP. And actually, there was just recently, of course, a live show announced happening in early May in New York City. I will be there. And what's going to be really special about that is that it's just a chance to connect with the community and connect with some of the awesome people that you've heard from on Pod Friends and so many others that we have yet to hear from. And so that's one reason, because there are discounted tickets, early opportunities to buy those tickets. But even more, what's so phenomenal is the community, the patron community. And it's not only the Facebook group and Discord, but patron events, special podcasts. The list goes on and on. There's all of it. And it's the star of the month. So it's the perfect time to subscribe. But, you know, I just want to give you all a big shout out, because this is one of the last times that I kind of will get to speak to the audience in this way, other than my outro. Just to thank you for, and really to thank Rob Sesternino and the RHAP team, who I won't go through naming everyone, but you know who you are, for really making space for my voice, not only for me as someone who, you know, for a long time before being in the class of 20, didn't really know how I would fit in or what my place would be if I would fit into RHAP. But also, like, as a young Black queer person, I'm just so thankful for the opportunity to have these conversations. And, you know, this is a meaningful week for me, because March 8th, as I mentioned in my interview with Kirsten, was when my dad passed away. And it's so interesting, because in talking with Wendell, another young Black man, you know, we talk about our dads, and I'm just so thankful that to kind of maybe have this episode to accomplish a lot of things, but in one sense to really honor his memory, because I know he'd be really proud of that. But thank you so much, everybody, for kind of listening to me talk and putting up with me. And without further ado, here is the introduction. Here is my guest announcement for Wendell.
Making his way to the podcast, hailing from the western suburbs of Philadelphia with degrees from Morehouse College and Penn Law, he's an entrepreneur, a designer, and as you know, a survivor. Please welcome from HGTV's Hot Mess House and Hometown Takeover, Discovery Plus's Beach Cabana Royale, Survivor Ghost Island and Winners at War, and so much more to come. He's a winner in more ways than one, and Manifest is about to become a staple on all of your digital screens. He's the best kept secret in entertainment, the most underrated Survivor winner of the new era, and an insanely good human being. Give it up for the founder of Beav Unlimited, the co-creator of Bryce One Presents, and the staple of the Purple Pants podcast, your pod friend and mine, Wendell Holland.
When I moisturize my hands, this is going to sound weird.
Yeah.
I use Vaseline.
No, that makes sense.
Okay. Because, like, you know, yeah. I work with my hands.
Yeah.
So right now I'm getting ready by properly moisturizing my hands. You got to get the cuticles.
Uh-huh.
And then you get in between, and then you use the rest for the rest. And
you got to really take care of the, and you know what? Oh, wait.
See?
Okay. Wait, I have, actually, it's funny. I have, Aveeno, daily. I'm going to get my, like, see, this is what you really need though, for that. Like, it really sticks in there and gets in there.
See, Aveeno is like, that's top shelf. That's rather bougie. Honey.
It's funny, because my mom said, like, a month ago, we had Aveeno in the house growing up, I'm just saying. But she was like, you know what you need? Because I was like, it's so dry here in D.C. She's like, you should get Aveeno. And it's like, you know what? I'll take your advice for once. So I actually did it. Ooh, this is good. This could be an entire podcast.
It could, because I just went with the residuals. I went down and did the feet too. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I can't do that while, like, I mean, I could, but that's just like, this could be the whole hour, maybe.
we'll reserve our moisturizing content.
Gotta get the moisture in
for the next one. But this is yes. The one with the cocoa butter.
Oh my God. See, look, I have some sweet, look, we're not good. I was going to say, do I go get my cocoa butter? Okay. I have some cocoa butter spray, some oil. Ooh, just put that on. Glistening. That's what's all
so
about.
If we're going down that rabbit hole, my routine after I shower, mm-hmm. and it might be backwards, but this is just what I do. I use the cocoa butter body oil
to
moisturize. And mm-hmm. then I use some like shea butter. I think it's called African black soap.
Lotion.
And mm-hmm. I go over the oil with that. So I'm, you know, so you I lock really, in the moisture.
That's what I was going to say. You have to lock in the moisture. That's right. Look. You know. I don't have this, not the same exact, but I do that too. Look at that. Look at us.
We gotta preserve it.
Skincare, taking care of it, shining. You know, that's why you look like you're 16, except for the beard.
You'd be surprised with some of these high school kids though, man. Like,
I know.
These youngins have beards, especially in Philly, man.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, even in DC.
Okay.
I used to volunteer with, actually, I still volunteer sometimes. I guess it's been a while since I've been like in person volunteering with like the DC high schoolers, but like they, for a while, I got confused for one. Like they thought I was 16. They were like, what class are you? Still, I'll be around them. And they're like, oh, which school do you go to? I'm like, I did, that was me like 12. I'm almost 30 now. So like, it's been a minute. It's been a minute since I was in high school.
You could pass for a real youngin'. You could pass for like college, high school. Especially with a clean face.
See, I've thought about this a little bit. Like, you know, if I need a backup career, maybe I could be on like the Disney Channel or something like that. You know, maybe I could have my own show, you know, have a second career in my 30s. Cause you know, back in the day, they used to have like all of those actors who are actually like 50, but they're playing high schoolers.
Yep.
That could be me one day.
Don't they still do that in Euphoria?
Probably. I don't know either.
I heard about it.
Yeah. We should do a Euphoria podcast because neither of us watch it. So maybe that would
we
work.
Could just do all hearsay. Like things
that's
that
literally it.
That's it.
I heard it's a good show. That's about it.
I heard it can push people either way, and it might be a little disturbing. And these are high school kids. I don't know. Maybe I'm just being old. I don't know. Maybe I need to keep watching. I've watched maybe like 3 episodes of season 1. I'm trying to get through it.
I don't want you to get canceled at the start of this interview for any of your TV takes. And like, look, I'm just watching out for you. But like, there's so much that we could dive into doing this other than our skincare routine, which is a very important thing. You know, cocoa. You need to get the cocoa butter oil and lock it in. I'm wondering, because like you are sitting there beautifully surrounded by the light, by these plants. Like, what? Okay, where are you now? What is going on? Why are you basically in like an indoor safari? Because that's what you're giving right now for those who are watching the YouTube version of this. Well,
I have some of my plants around me. This is my living room. Gets mm-hmm. pretty good light. Mm-hmm. And because it's the winter here in Philadelphia. Well, I live in the western suburbs. I live in Ardmore, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. It's the winter here, so I had to bring in a lot of my plants from outside. This is maybe like a quarter or a fifth of my collection, but they're chilling in here, getting some good light, thriving. That's where I am. Ardmore, PA, represent.
Yeah. Did you discover like a love of plants first or of building things? Like where did the plant thing come from? Because I didn't like realize that you were as passionate about houseplants as you were, but it's very clear. It's very clear that you have a strong relationship with many houseplants. So
I got some houseplant books chilling from our boy Hilton Carter.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I love plants. One is even signed. I was able to meet Hilton. Yeah. I messaged him here and there. I desire to work with him one day. That's the first thing we're going to manifest on this podcast.
Yeah. We're manifesting it.
Working with Hilton Carter one day.
Working with Hilton Carter. Shout out to Hilton Carter.
Yeah, he's the GOAT, man. He does awesome things. Very motivating and inspirational with his plant care and the things he posts.
Yeah. But
you asked if I developed my love for building or plant life first.
Yeah.
And I grew up since fifth grade in a house with a pretty nice sunroom. And my mom had a lot of plants in there. And I was always like, mom's kind of the weird plant lady a little bit. Like, I don't see it. Like, I don't get this allure, this plant life. Shout out to Mom Duke. She's not weird. She's loving. She's beautiful. She's the greatest.
I was going to say, that's good to add that in too. Shout out to Mom.
Yeah, shout out to Mom. But I started building at a very young age too. My dad, he works, he's an attorney. He also had other jobs like in the government and things and on boards and stuff. But he would come home and he would like, we'd frame out the basement. We'd drywall the basement at a young age. I'm talking second, third, fourth grade. I'm helping him out. I'm learning how to use a hammer and nails and screws and the drill. And I started like building little things on my own, even way back then. And forts outside and tree houses and just little things. He just let me do it. He let me be imaginative.
Yeah.
And so that was that creative outlet. I've always needed creative outlets and building was one of them going back. And then actually like painting and other things. But that building desire and passion kind of like reignited back in like 2013, 2014, when I needed a bed for myself and I built my own bed. And then I was like, all right, I got something here. I can build. This is a pretty dope bed. If I look at that bed now, I'm like,
yeah,
that bed sucks. But back then I was feeling myself. So, I'd say that the passion for building was definitely longer than the plant life, the passion for plant life, which actually might have come on Survivor when I got off the island.
Wow.
And I started wanting to bring little plants into my apartment.
Yeah. Wow. That's really
became a jungle.
Wow. That's deep. That's wild. Cause like now that I'm looking at it, now that you put it like that, I'm like, wait, is Wendell out on the island right now? Like what's happening? Is that, you know, I could see it. I could see it, but you know, like, so you mentioned, there's a lot there that you already mentioned. And one thing I'm wondering, cause you mentioned the creativity aspect of it. Like, is there something that you're most, well, actually, I guess it's like two questions. What was the last thing that you built? And then what was like the coolest thing that you built?
All right. So as of late, I've been a little busy. Like I was filming a new HGTV show. Shameless plug. It ended maybe like, thank you. It ended maybe like 3 weeks ago. They were bringing me down to Wilmington, North Carolina a few times a month for the last like 6 months. So I've been a little busy with that. And this is the HGTV is like one of my goals. I'm a goal setter. Mm-hmm. That's like one of those things that I'm like, I want it.
Yeah.
Kind of like Survivor.
Yeah.
So building was kind of on the back burner a little bit. I'd come home, me and Joey, Bryce, Chris, we'd come in and build a few things. But for the most part, I was very selective with the pieces I was taking on because I didn't have much time. And I had to, you know, get the energy to be able to be a proper host. So I had to actually take my downtime and, you know, rejuvenate at home. So but it finished 3 weeks ago. So we were able to do, we had an awesome piece that we delivered to the No Dunks podcast in Atlanta. There are some really cool dudes that coincidentally happen to be Survivor fans. And they, a few years back, because I went to Morehouse and I always go to Atlanta, I always go for homecoming despite COVID and there not being homecoming. I was I was in Atlanta with my buddies during a homecoming. We decided to go to a Hawks game and I'm just walking around. I got hooked up with some tickets or something. And as I'm leaving, I hear these guys calling me like, Wendell. And they rolled up on me. It was the guys from this podcast 3-4 years ago. I'm like, yo, I recognize you guys. They used to have a show. And they're like, yeah, we're big Survivor fans. We want to, you know, we want to work with you or interview you one day. So next time I went to Atlanta, I interviewed with them. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to a couple weeks ago. This is now me knowing them 2-3 years. And I delivered a beautiful podcast table for them in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. and a sign that says no dunks. So
yeah, they were working, that on Instagram.
Yeah, they were working off of a ping pong table, and I upgraded them to this beautiful oak table with the steel legs. So that was my last like nice project.
There we go. And like, what's the thing that you're kind of, is there a thing that you're proudest of that you've built so far? I feel like I'm not trying to put you on the spot, get you to choose favorites.
Yeah.
But is there something that kind of jumps out, even if it wasn't one of the projects that you, it was it something that you've done with Beeve? Was it before that? Was it the bed? It sounds like it wasn't the bed that you made for yourself back in 2013, 2014.
That was the spark though. So like, yeah. You know, that was like, yeah. So the bed was great and it started this thing, which changed my whole trajectory. But I'd say there was a really cool bed that we made for a friend's 3-year-old daughter. Mm-hmm. They are, they're a little fancy. So they wanted their fancy princess to have a castle of a bed at the tender age of 3.
Right.
So they wanted it to be a bunk bed.
Uh-huh.
But look like a castle. And they didn't want it for regular twin beds. They wanted it for full-size beds. Mm-hmm. So it's a bunk bed castle for full beds. And we took our time and made that. It came out real nice. This was like maybe like 4 or 5 years ago now.
Yeah.
But that was an awesome project that it was difficult for me to wrap my head around it. But I was able to do that for them. And then there was the things I did on Hot Mess House.
Yeah.
I had to be very creative with that. Like a table that pulls off the wall that when it's up, uh-huh, looks like a picture frame.
Yeah.
Or like a unit in the, like an ottoman that if you flip the top, it reveals a race car track for the kids. Mm-hmm. So we did a lot of really cool creative things on that show also. For TV. Cause you know, they want something really cool and creative. So all the projects on Hot Mess House were pretty dope too.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I think it's, I would encourage anyone to go check that out. I've checked out Hot Mess House. And I know a lot of people are just fans of it. I know that some of the people in the RHAP community are wondering when it comes back. So that's a whole other conversation for another time. I'm assuming no spoilers. But actually, one thing I want to just dive into to really like go back with your story is, well, one, I think it's really interesting that your father's story, your dad's story, and yours, or at least like the things that you've gravitated to, are so similar. And I don't know exactly where, but I remember you like mentioning either in interviews or maybe it was even on Survivor, but like talking about your dad. And I just think it's so interesting that, you know, you've both had this more, I always forget like which is the left and the right side of the brain. So I'm not going to try to be fancy like that, but okay. Like there's like the more like you have the law, the legal side of things, that side of that thing that's drawing you that direction. And then there's the creativity with building. And I kind of want to go back, like, where did you mentioned kind of like your dad and your mom, but like, as you grew up, like, how did that creativity manifest? Because obviously maybe you were working on some projects with your dad. What did that look like? Because clearly it was a little bit of a while. You were an adult when you started Beeve and committed to mm-hmm. that career. So mm-hmm. like, yeah, what were you like growing up and how was that creativity, but also that other side of the brainedness part of it?
So I think if I'm not mistaken,
yeah,
I'm sure they'll correct me if I'm wrong. I think your left side is your analytical side. And your right brain is your creative side, I think.
I'll go with that.
Sure, why not?
50% chance, that's right.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. May or may not be wrong. You say it with confidence and, uh-huh. you know, maybe they won't check you on it. But so I've juggled both sides. I think I am the more creative type for sure. But, you know, I went to law school and Penn Law. When I applied, that was my number one. It was a top 10. It's a top 10 law school. Mm-hmm. It took a lot for me to get in there. I did my thing at Morehouse College. Like I was like very high. I did my thing. And so I was able to get into Penn, and I had to really lock in, and it wasn't the easiest of times for me, but mm-hmm. I was able to graduate, clerk for judges, and have these pretty interesting jobs. But mm-hmm. So I definitely have that side to me. But I think growing up, my parents, they gave me a lot of freedom to express myself, and they never limited me. My dad worked extremely hard. He grew up poor. He made mm-hmm. he made a great life for himself and his family. And he never showed me or my two sisters any of his failures. Even mm-hmm. now, like, he talked back about, like, man, I got fired from this job, or they let me go from this job. I never saw it. My sisters, wow. we never saw it. We just saw my dad doing his thing, killing it, being a superhero, my idol, yeah. right? And I think that kind of shielding us from that, or shielding me, his only son, his namesake, mm-hmm. from that,
yeah,
made me think, like, he's killing it. There's nothing he can't do. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing I can't do. Yeah. And so with that kind of a childhood, and then he's like, they call him, some people call him around here, like, the Black James Bond. He traveled the world a lot and stuff. And one of his friends, an ambassador from South Africa, uh-huh. she sent her son over to stay with my family for like a few weeks. Then this is a different family. When I was in seventh grade, we had one of the ministers of transportation or something from Tanzania. I was getting my wow. stories confused. From Tanzania, he sent his sons on different occasions to stay with us for the full summer when yeah. I was a little kid. And so my dad, when I was in seventh grade, he sent me over to stay in Tanzania with them for a whole summer. And as a little kid traveling to the continent of Africa, you don't know what you're going to get. And out yeah. there, I was just like, it was great because I'm staying with this this very well-established, incredible family, this mm-hmm. like dignified, like awesome, great family. But then they take me around the country to like the villages where their family lives and stuff.
Yeah.
And this family was kind of like, they were very well-esteemed, but they'd bring mm-hmm. me like to little huts, and I'm eating, you know, out of my hands, and I'd see these amazing, happy, beautiful people out there that have created like little fences with sticks, and they used what they had and they created all this cool wow. stuff. So yeah. I was, as an imaginative kid, I was able to go out there and see basically these people that made so much from little, or from mm-hmm. what we think is like is not a lot of material things. So when I came back home that same summer, I went in my parents' backyard and I was building like these bike trails just with like sticks and wood and rope and stuff and Damn. Things that I saw in Tanzania. This is a long way of saying like
yeah.
My parents, they allowed me to do these things and see the world at a very young age. And they kind of didn't give me any limits or encumbrances, or they allowed me to think that I could do anything. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I think I came back with an even broader world sense and just a desire in me to say that me, this Black boy from Ardmore, I really yeah. can do anything. And there is nothing that will or can stand in my way, because I've never learned that things stand in people's ways like mm-hmm. that. So I attribute a lot of where I am to how I was raised.
Wow, that is deep, and it's powerful too. And I love it, because when I think about how I grew up, even, you know, like, and there are definitely a lot of similarities in terms of like my dad, for instance. I saw him killing it in so many ways, and he was definitely such a strong role model for me. And it's so powerful. I will shout it out, because this, like, he passed away 5 years ago, March 8th. So like this interview and the fact that we're talking about our dads and their influence is like so powerful and meaningful. But I think the thing that's one of the things that's been so beautiful in the last 5 years is that it's given me the appreciation as a young person, like, damn, my parents gave me so many tools that I still draw on and still am able to kind of leverage in my life. And, you know, something I think about a lot, people talk about like, they talk about quote unquote toxic positivity, which I think is a thing. Sometimes people are like, you could do anything you want, and they don't give the limitations around that. But I will say, and it sounds like you're kind of coming from this place too, that like, we kind of have realized like, yeah, we can do it. There's so much that we could do, and there aren't limitations. And one thing I love about your story is that you have we've both had those realizations. You've had that realization. And then there are all of these things that other people are able to see where they're able to be like, ah, that's what Wendell means. Like, it's not an accident that Wendell goes on to win Survivor, or Wendell goes on to, you know, everything with Beav or HGTV, right? And so that is like all really powerful. But also, I will say, I grew up in a household where my parents were like, okay, we're going to get somebody to put this thing together. That is not me. That is not.
Oh,
me.
No. When senior, we were putting whatever it was together to this day.
But I think it's like, it's so, no, go for it. Totally.
I was just going to say, I am known to ramble. I'm known to talk a lot.
We love it.
Feel free. No, if I'm like going on one of my tangents, and this might be why I wasn't good at Survivor Confessionals, because I just keep talking and going and going, and they can't cut it into the right sound bites that they need. But if I do, let me know when. Yo, shut up. You're doing one of those tangents. Just let me know and I'll.
Damn. No. You're great. You're great. No, this is perfect. And I think, you know, this kind of leads me to this question, because you were really on this path to doing law and then went in a completely different direction. And I know there's a little bit of a story to that, but, you know, something that I know that people who are listening want to know is like, when did you realize that that was, or did you realize that that was the wrong career path for you? And then like, kind of how did you make that jump to follow your dreams, and do kind of, I guess, set you out on the path that you're on now?
Yeah. Great, great question. Probably another one of my long answers.
Oh, we love a long answer. People are here to listen to you.
Let's do that. Let's do this.
Yeah.
I got two waters here.
Yeah. I was going to say, you have to have all the drinks,
like, my breakfast shake. So I'm ready for a long talk, you know, but, I guess what set me in motion, I'm Wendell Holland Sr.'s name. Like, I'm Wendell F. Holland II. I am. Mm-hmm. And I've lived my life looking up to my dad. He was my hero. Yeah. And he was the kind of guy, as an attorney, that he was able to affect a lot of people's lives and help people and do other things like that. And he saw what being an attorney did for him and his family and the doors it opened and the other jobs that he was able to have. And he was the kind of person that encouraged a lot of people to go to law school. Mm-hmm. When I say a lot of people, pretty much anybody. You can have the most, you could be LeBron James and he's telling you to go to law school, or John Morant, he's telling you to go to law school. So, I mean, but you know, people have these other outlets. So at Morehouse, my goal at Morehouse, I had a cousin who went to Morehouse. He graduated in an honor society, Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society. It's like a very esteemed, like when you're top 10 or whatever percent of certain schools, you get that achievement. And he was the reason I went to Morehouse. And when I entered Morehouse, what they do is they really build you up and encourage you. It's an all black, all male school.
Yeah.
For those that don't know about it. And they have new student orientation where they tell you, they teach you about the school, its history, its purpose, the purpose of HBCUs, the distinguished alums from Morehouse. And they just build you up. And they're like, look, it's your job to go in here, kill it in here, and go out in the world and be great. That's what Morehouse does. So when I stepped in Morehouse with my cousin who just graduated Phi Beta Kappa, maybe 5-7 years prior, I'm like, yo, that's what I want to do. I want to graduate Phi Beta Kappa. So busted my behind, worked really hard, kept my grades high. Fortunately, it was a blessing. I was able to achieve Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society. And I was number one in the international studies department. It was, they called me the ranking scholar. It was like, I did my thing at Morehouse.
Yeah.
And as I'm going through Morehouse, still a creative kid, or a creative at heart, right. I needed an outlet. So I, at Morehouse, I built like some little things for my, for me and my roommate's apartment. Uh-huh. And I painted a little bit and hung some things on the wall. But then one summer I wanted to create a t-shirt that nobody had. And mm-hmm. back then, people were doing a lot with like the puffy paints, and like there was a brand called Mesquine, and they'd paint all over the shirt and they'd sell like these painted up shirts.
Yeah.
And that's a Philly company. Inspired by that, I created this one dope Morehouse shirt out of like puffy paints, because I'm creative. Mm-hmm. I need a creative outlet. I want something unique. And I wore that around campus, and the college store that was off campus saw me wearing it. They were like, "Yo, where'd you get that fire?"
Wow.
I'm like, "Well, I made it myself." So then they wanted me to start making. Yeah. I was like, "That's me. That's all me."
Yeah.
They wanted me to start making shirts for them. So then in college, as this guy who's locked into the books and everything, but who has always had a creative outlet, I started making t-shirts for that store. And then the Spelman store wanted stuff. Then my high school wanted stuff. So I started like making and selling shirts, and I had employees back then, and I showed them how to do it. And we were selling these, like these Morehouse, Spelman, my high school, Harrington High School, and other t-shirts at Morehouse. So for me, what that did was it gave me a great supplemental income. It showed me a lot about business and entrepreneurship, and it was a creative outlet for me.
Mm-hmm.
And being that guy on the Morehouse campus, they call me the t-shirt guy. And so being the t-shirt guy and walking around, and a lot of people knowing me out there for my creativity, but in actuality, me staying in the books. I remember a friend of mine named Belton. And I told him, I'm like, "Yeah, I'm applying to law schools. These are the ones I want to go to." And he looked at me like, "That's not for you. What, like, you can do it, but I see other things for you." And even back then, I was an international studies major. I had a few abroads that I'd done at Morehouse, some awesome ones. And what I wanted to be was either an ambassador or a senator. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, going to law school, that's a good stepping stone. It'll get me in the right direction.
Right.
And so that's like my right brain and left brain. It's, they've always been right there. But then so I apply to all these schools, get into Penn as a Philly boy. That's like the school. That's that was my top school in high school that I didn't get into. And then I get into it. I go there, and I even found a creative outlet at Penn Law, which was, you know, I'm studying, and law school, I didn't love it. It actually, something I don't talk about, it took me an extra year to graduate. I took some time off. I was depressed, and all these things that I don't show or talk about, but would be, it would be great and motivating for people to know that. But when I was at Penn Law, I took a course called Visual Legal Advocacy, where you shoot legal documentaries, and you so I was able to do something creative. They taught me how to work a camera, they taught me how to use Final Cut Pro, all these things that gave me that creative outlet that I always needed. And so at Penn Law, I took that course, then I took some independent studies where I was able to shoot other things. On the side, I would rent the camera out, well, sign the camera out,
right?
And like people around my neighborhood knew that I was shooting things, and they'd like get me to shoot rat videos for them and stuff like that. So I was always able to have this creative outlet. That might be why it took me an extra year to graduate law school. But I guess from there, I had my right brain and my left brain. I got to graduate, but I also need to do something cool. I graduate. I start clerking for a judge in civil court. And like, I'm seeing all these like power attorneys in the city, and I'm doing all this work for the judge. The law clerk is like the judge's brain, pretty much. You write opinions and do stuff. Judge signs off on things. Then when that judge retired, I moved over to family court. And that's when, Family Court to me was very, it brought me to a weird place. It's Family Court in Philadelphia. Yeah. And you see a lot of these sad stories.
Yeah.
You see parents coming in crying, fathers crying. You see the judge talking to children about how they're treated. The judge having candy to like induce, to give the kids, to induce them to speak more and to actually tell their stories. Miserable people. I was signing like protection from abuse orders and other things. And it was just, it's just not a great place. And in Philadelphia, you see a lot of Black folks coming in there. I see people looking like me, just getting their families ripped apart on a daily basis. It wasn't my happiest of places. My judge was awesome to me, but like, I wasn't feeling good when I sat in court. Fortunately, that was when I started building things for myself. That's when I started like building my own bed. I was so happy, posted it on social media. People hit me up like, oh my gosh, it looks great. You did great, blah, blah, blah. So that's what got me into selling what I was making. But it was all from this place of being in the court, but also like I had been at Morehouse and at law school, I needed that creative outlet. And sometimes it was painting on t-shirts. Sometimes it was filming documentaries. This time it was that childhood thing that I did, built stuff, and that that blossomed. So again, my long story to get to that's kind of what started Beef. Just me building something, posting it, friends and family liking it, and then one thing leading to another.
Wow. That is like, there's so many levels to what you said. I feel like I could just sit back and like listen to these stories. Cause it's like, I have to mention like some of the things that just came up for me. One is that clearly there's a pattern, and I'm sure people will pick up on this, but you're creating the things that you need in your life, creating the outlets you need. So it's not like, oh, I really want to create and build things, so I'm going to go apply to find a job and I'm going to look up companies and blah, blah, blah. No. You just created that. And it goes for the shirts. It goes for the furniture, all of that stuff. But then the other part that I think is so powerful, again, that I see as a pattern just in everything you said there, was you're telling people about it. Like, you're letting people know what you're passionate about. You're kind of like, you're being visible in that way so that people could then say, when we want you to make some stuff for us, or, you know, like they could spread the word or tell their friends. And so I feel like there's like a deep lesson there, but even more, I will say, I've considered law school barely. It's not, I don't think it's for me, but you know, like you'll have like someone like your dad, heck, I ran into your dad at some point and he was like, you should go to law school. And I was like, I don't know about that, Mr. Holland, but Mr. Holland Senior. But you know, I think like it's interesting because I wouldn't have imagined that there was like filmmaking in law school. And like, I don't think that's necessarily a reason to go to law school. And there are a lot of reasons not to, but like, damn, I'm like, okay, I could see myself sneaking into a law school course and like doing that. Cause that sounds really interesting. But wow, there's so much there. Yeah. I actually have like another question though, that I want to ask, because as you talk about this journey, and you know, of course we'll get to like a little bit of Survivor, and like, of course, there's so much more to get to in your story. But I just think it's interesting that you went to Morehouse. My dad also went to an HBCU and was like telling me to go to an HBCU. So he went
Where
to
did
Howard.
He go?
Howard.
HU. Howard.
Yeah. So I'm in DC. I went to a PWI, primarily white institution, the George Washington University.
Great school.
I wish I probably went to Howard, but you know, I could still go for grad school. I don't know if you just said grad school, but that's what I heard. So I'm like, damn.
Well, I said it's a great school.
Yeah.
But Howard, there's no but.
Yeah.
And yeah. Howard. So the cousin that I followed to Morehouse.
Yeah.
His older sister.
Yeah.
Is the cousin that my sister followed to Howard.
Okay.
So like, those cousins of mine who are doing tremendous things right now, they inspired us to both go to HBCUs. So the same love that I have for Morehouse, I have it for Howard.
Yeah.
And coincidentally, you said your father passed on March 8th.
Yeah, March 8th.
March 8th is coming up soon, and that's also my birthday.
What?
Yeah.
Look at this. So much coming together. I don't know. Yeah. There's a lot there, but I actually want to, like, in the spirit of covering a lot of grounds here with you today, I'm like curious about just that shift. So growing up in Philly and then going to Morehouse, being surrounded by Black people, of course, and then you go to Penn Law, like, I wonder what was like, was there anything notable about that experience just from like the perspective of being a Black man at Penn Law? Were there other Black people there? I've actually been reading a book, that's more, I think, about like high school experience. And it's called Admissions, and it's by, Kendra something, and I'm blanking and I feel bad about that, but she talks a lot about like her experience as a Black person, again, in a primarily white institution. Like, what was that experience like for you?
Different. So I grew up in a white area, a very Jewish area, very white area. But my parents made it a point to bring me to like the Black neighborhoods, put me in the Black camps for basketball. I'm in the Sunny Hill League. That's the league in the city at Temple U. So like my dad made it a point to make sure that I was cultured. I knew who I was. My mother's Guyanese. She made it a point for me to know my history, and be in tune with that. We were in the Black church growing up. So despite where we lived, I was in tune with my culture and who I was, I was still at I went to Harrington High School in Lower Marion, and I was one of the few Black kids there, you know, so I was different. I was different then. And then when I came to Morehouse, this all Black school, I didn't know what I was getting into. I just know that my cousin, who did so well, spoke so highly about it. And he said, he calls me Beef. He was like, Beef.
Yeah.
When you go to Morehouse, you're going to see the whole spectrum of your people. And I'm like, well, I come from a great family. I killed it at sports. I'm like, I'm the man, you know, I'm going to be down there and I'm the man. So then I get down there and I look over and it's Denzel's kid, JD Washington. And I'm like, oh, he comes from a better family. He was killing it at sports. He's playing football at Morehouse right now, killing it. Now you see him on like TV shows and stuff and movies. But I'm like, oh, this is what Morehouse is about. I became friends with my buddy Gabe, who came from like, he came from DC. He went to Georgetown Prep. He was like brilliant at Morehouse, killing it on his LSAT. Then I'm like, so I'm seeing all these people down there that I'm just like, whoa, these people, this is greatness that I'm surrounded by. So I need to step my game up. I came here thinking I would be the man, but no, they're all the men. Like, these guys are next level. Then I'd see the dudes that listen to heavy metal. I'd see the dudes that are skateboarders. I'd really see the diversity of our people at Morehouse. I'm like, you know what? I might have had a skewed perception of my own culture and my own people before coming to this institution. So at Morehouse, what I was able I was able to gain a lot of confidence and just understand how diverse Black people can be. And I mean, there were white people at Morehouse too.
Yeah.
A couple, you know, a few
of
them.
Right.
They were always like, they were super cool for, you know, for them to be in a school with all brothers, they had to be like, you know, really cool. So that was my Morehouse experience. It was an experience where I saw a lot of people that looked just like me in a country that doesn't always portray such imagery, in a country that doesn't always uplift Black men. I stepped into a school that just showed me like all my friends from here are going to top 10 grad schools or Wall Street or starting a business or doing these things. This is what you're supposed to be doing. That was great for Morehouse. So I'm like, you know what? I didn't get into Penn Law when I was in high school. I'm sorry. I didn't get into Penn when I was in high school.
Right.
I'm going to get in there out of Morehouse. And so then I go to law school and it is different. It's different than Morehouse. Morehouse was nurturing. Law school is a bunch of like, you got to, you do your thing and study up and get out of here. And so it was difficult for me. It was harder. I mentioned that I was like, I kind of had like a little depression and other things. Yeah. And thankfully I found my creative outlet. As a 1L, I was in my Civ Pro, civil procedure professor. Her name is Amy Wax. She, just Google Amy Wax Penn Law. She is like, she has been making noise by saying a lot of like, almost like white supremacist kind of, or like things to insinuate that minorities don't succeed as well or don't do as well. And like, she's very controversial. So for me to step into a school and that is one of my first professors I'm meeting, I don't know, like it, granted, I found some great professors that were really like nurturing and uplifting, but it was very different than Morehouse. And I guess my output showed that. And so, but it's also like, you're not going to exist in an all black world. So it's good for me to have that Morehouse education that lifted me up. That's like, yo, you can do whatever you want. In my childhood, I said, my parents didn't give me any limitations. So that was very affirming. And then I think that was able to just put me out in the world where, in a world where I am very confident. I'm very loving. I like building people up. That's all also from Morehouse. Like, I want to build my brothers up. I want to motivate people of all races. I love motivating people. But again, you're not going to live in an all black world. So Penn Law kind of snapped me back to reality. Like, all right, the world is also kind of a harsh place. And you, the kid who went to a very white high school, a very black college, and a very white law school, you're now prepared for the world because, but with this added like a confidence that on the show, it kind of showed as like a cockiness, but that's different. I don't know. On the show, like, I'm a competitor. I play basketball and all that stuff my whole life. And I know on the basketball court, we talk a little bit of shit, you know, we do our thing. So like, in the show, I'm like talking a little trash to props while I'm doing something, but I thought it was more friendly, but you know,
But anyway. Well, actually getting to that, cause like, I know like with your story, so you were talking about being a law clerk and then the judge retired, right? And then
I'll put a button on that. The family court judge retired.
Family court judge retired.
At that point, I was applying heavy for Survivor, applying. So it took me 7 years to get on. And but then I started building and I changed my look a little, grew my fro and I was like real clean cut. So then I changed that look and that's when they received me and they wanted me on the show. It was like after I started my business on my own within 2 years after applying for 5 years prior, I was on Survivor.
Yeah. So first of all, I want to talk a little bit about that. But first, like you mentioned, it was read as cockiness, you know, but I will say that, like, and I find this even talking with my mom, where sometimes she's like, you know, because we talk, you have a different relationship with your parents than you do with other people. And sometimes with her, I have to say, like, oh no, I'm like really confident in this. Like, I know I've got this, like this thing I know I've got. There's so much, like, especially as a young black queer person in this world that I could doubt about myself. And so you have to almost like aggressively take up space and be cocky, not only for other people to see that you're capable, but for you to like remind yourself of that. Or at least for me, that's part of it. But I want to ask like specifically, because somebody did ask me, to ask you this, did you have like certain types of Survivor challenges that were your favorites? Was it the endurance ones, the obstacle ones? Like, what were the ones that you were the cockiest about, let's say, or the most confident about?
Let's say the most confident. But yeah, that confidence, I think it could be a defense mechanism for people that look like us. And so I think it's in a world where you are told that you can't do things, you better hold your head high and do things, you know? And for me was Survivor. I made it on Survivor. Like, I got on this show that I've been applying for years.
Yeah.
You can't tell me nothing. I'm going to be out there and I'm going to be happy and I'm going to be yelling at props and I'm going to be running around and I'm going to be building a bunch of stuff. You can't, like, I made it on Survivor. So yeah. So my first season, I wanted to, like, I had that in me, but I was like, I got to win this thing. So when certain people would say certain things to microaggressions and whatnot.
Exactly.
I'd be like, Laurel would be like, yo, Wendell, I can't believe you said that to me. I'd be like, Laurel, you and I are going to sit here at the end. So
yeah,
let's not react right now. That was kind of like the Obama philosophy. Like he got hit with so much stuff, but he didn't respond. The State of the Union was last night. I remember when that guy screamed out, you lied to him at the State of the Union.
Yeah.
I was looking in the mirror thinking about that just last night. And I'm like, what face would I have made at that guy? Like, or what would I have done to that guy at that moment? Obama didn't do it. He looked at him and he kept it moving. So on Ghost Island, that's what I wanted to, like, just, if I hear anything, I wouldn't react unless I had to. And I try to just keep it all very, like, very, very calm and collect. And it served me very well out there.
Mm-hmm.
Winners at War, I wanted to loosen up a little bit. Okay. I was a little more loose. I had a little more fun. It was portrayed a little differently. But to answer the question and put a button on this, my favorite challenges are the ones where we're doing a lot of stuff. We start in the water. We're swimming. We grab a sandbag. We do this. We do that. All the obstacles that end with a puzzle.
Okay.
That's what I love. So because the way I see it, I'm going to beat y'all at the obstacles and I'm going to beat y'all at the puzzle. So, but it levels the playing field. So, like, I'd probably on Ghost Island, I was able to get to the puzzle first or within the top couple. And I was able to really, like, I love puzzles. I'm good at puzzles. On the LSAT, there was the logic game section, which is like, it's almost like a puzzle section. The things I build, I have a headboard that I call the patchwork style headboard. It's a million scrap pieces of wood just pieced together like a puzzle. So I love puzzles. So it's something that I'm pretty good at. And so that's the challenge that I love.
Yeah, but I mean, even more, like, kind of to widen out again, to, like, the broader experience implications of, you know, you won, you're a winner. We'll make sure that that's clear in case anyone didn't know. But, you know, I, being a Black winner, 'cause there are only so many, unfortunately. Do you feel like that put you in a position where, like, you had to be an advocate or a voice for Black people? Like, how was that? How was that experience different in short, I guess?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. In short.
Well, you could go on if you want forever about it too, but I'm sure there's, like, I realize it's that could be its own podcast. And I'm sure, I know thankfully there have been a handful of podcasts that have talked a little bit about that, but, like, what was that experience like, and did it put you in an advocacy position? And then also, like, how did that feel for you, just kind of navigating that experience as a Black winner who I know a lot of people sought to invalidate and for whatever reasons, you know?
So first and foremost, right when we got off the island, me, Dom, and Laurel, we were super tight on the island. We were sure that Dom and I tied. Laurel had to break the tie. She had to break the tie, our ally, our sister out there. And we had this 8-month span before the season even started, or however long it was before it even aired, right? So we knew what happened. We knew a Black dude from Philly and a white dude from Long Island tied at the end of Survivor. Dom and I, during that 8-month span, we were super cool. We'd hang out. We'd go to Brooklyn Nets games with Chris Noble. And we're still this tight. But we knew the larger implications or how that would be viewed. And Dom and I made it a point, like, there's nothing that will break our friendship that can be portrayed or come out or anything through the season or after the tie. We communicated that to each other. And we said, like, we know that this was 2018. This is during Trump's presidency. America's a little funny right now, a lot funny and polarized. We won't allow what happened on this island to separate us, to break us apart as friends. And it's even more powerful that we make sure people see that. Me, a black man, him, a white man, right, being best friends on this show, but also outside of the show, despite people trying to say whatever. Laurel voted for you because you're black, or this, that. Don played a better game. He was more strategic. He dragged. Whatever they say and would say, Dom and I would find ways to defend the other person. I defend Dom. He defend me. We defend Laurel. And she might have gotten more flack than any of us.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
So coming out of that season, I knew that I had to be very smart with my words and how but at the end of the day, we both played tremendous games and it showed throughout the votes. And that is what it is. Mm-hmm. We tied. We were locked in together, but ultimately I got the edge at the end and I won, and that changed things for me. And I started getting a lot more press, and that's when the HGTV shows and things came to me. And I thought that I did a good job representing who I was on Ghost Island, and I thought that they did a good job portraying it. And that's who I think when people meet me in real life, which is, that's been a good thing from Ghost Island through Winners at War. So Winners at War, I got a lot of flack, but I met a lot of people between Ghost Island and Winners at War. I had watch parties. I wanted to be everywhere. And when people meet me in real life, I think they get the Ghost Island Wendell. And I think that's what helped on Winners at War, when the people that don't know me were saying a lot of stuff about me. Then I'd see the people that I have met defending me. So it I just try to be the same person. I just try to be me when I meet people. I love meeting Survivor fans. And the people that don't know me or haven't met me, they might have their perceptions of me because of how I was portrayed on Winners at War, but I just encourage them to dig a little deeper and maybe listen to podcast interviews, or maybe come to one of my parties and meet me in real life, and they might change their opinion.
Yeah. And then have you found yourself like in a position where you are, because I think especially maybe less so when your season was happening, or when your first season was happening, but more, you know, especially after Winners at War, because we saw just the Survivor Diversity campaign come around, and the Black Survivor Alliance, and just this big push. And of course, we thankfully saw CBS Viacom's diversity commitment when it comes to 50% BIPOC representation. So that's powerful. But have you found yourself just considering the fact that you were like, or you are really one of the only Black winners, like, in an advocacy position, or, and kind of how has that been speaking to the experience of being a Black person out on that island?
Yeah. So, I consider myself an ambassador for the show, and I know that I'm the last Black winner, and my favorite winner before me was Jeremy Collins.
Well, wait a minute. Not the last one, but the last one. I know what you mean. Because we're gonna have everyone else who's gonna win from here on is gonna be Black.
We'll talk about that too. So the latest Black winner. There will be more many Black winners, and there will be many women winners.
Exactly.
Going forward.
Yeah.
I consider myself kind of like a big bro to people, and I try to, like, people come off the show with different perspectives. And I understand that my first time I came off the show with a skewed perception because I was a winner. And from my experience out there, it's on level 1,000. My portrayal on my winning season, it's on level 1,000. So I came off on this high that only, you know, there were 41 people have been able to achieve out of the hundreds of people that have played. So I recognize that my first experience is not the normal experience. But then my second experience really brought me to earth and showed me that this is how some people feel on this show. And with that, I was able to, like, first of all, I got super depressed during those few episodes and whatnot, lower than I've ever been from the comments that I got online. I have a 13-minute long video still on my phone of me blocking people, Survivor fans, from the negative stuff that they said on my social media. 13 minutes long, and I keep it so I can remember where I was. And I'll show it to you the next time I see you. But the worst of comments, telling me to kill myself, racial slurs, all these things in my comments. And so that experience, I had this super high experience and this super low experience. And I told myself, I'm done with Survivor. I recall I didn't know why I was portrayed that way. Right now, I'm chalking it up to, like, all right, they needed a funny or they needed a cute storyline. Wendell and Michelle used to date, and we're going to make it about her hating him and getting whatever. Right. They knew that wasn't what was going on the island. But for some reason, they chose me, the one of two Black people on the island, the newest Black winner, the one of the latest two winners. It was just me and Nick, and then it was season 40 that was on the island, and they buried me. And so because I was so depressed and upset and angry, I was like, I'm done with Survivor. I'm not gonna post. I'm gonna walk away from this community. And that's one way that you can respond to things. And in my case, I thought it was justified. I had HGTV opportunities for one huge show that I turned down because I'm loyal and I wanted to go back on Survivor 40. So I said no to that show and I went on Survivor 40. And they knew that. So I was so low. And so, yeah, you can walk away. But then there was kind of like this magnitude of this moment. It was 2020, George Floyd, Black Lives Matter movement. And there's something that I learned from my father. It's about harnessing the moment or striking at a certain time. And these groups started getting together. These Black groups started getting together and saying, all right, we need to make something happen right now. Like, while the world is watching, now is the time that things can change. So with the Soul Survivor Alliance, I was like, you know what? I have that experience where I felt like I was unfairly portrayed. Now I have an experience that I know a lot of other Black players have had, and they've walked away from Survivor. But now I'm going to use that. And instead of walking away, I'm going to try to change Survivor. So there were like 8 of us, 10 of us, and we had a Zoom with Probst and a lot of other higher ups. Jatia had this change.org petition that we were blasting.
I remember that.
Yeah, and that was the time to shake things up and say, you know what? This thing harmed me. I felt like I was done wrong, but I'm going to use all of that, whatever it is inside of me, and try to change this thing and make it better for those that come after me. So after that diversity initiative, we had this Zoom with Probst. I told him exactly what I just communicated, how low I was. The other folks told them about their experiences. Bryce spoke about being the first openly gay Black male on the show. Yeah. He was the third boot. Bryce is killing it right now. You know, like, imagine if Survivor was ready for Bryce at that time. I don't think Survivor America was ready for that character at that time. If that fool was on the show, he'd kill it today. Everyone, Jatia and her portrayal, this brilliant woman. They got her looking crazy. I mean, she did some.
Look, I'm just going to say, look, the rice is in the fire, whatever. I mean, it was a choice. It was a choice. But I mean, like, you know, the fact that someone who's that brilliant, not to interrupt you, but the fact that someone who's that brilliant could then be simplified down to like one moment or one memory or being like, oh, this is the crazy person, quote unquote. that's not right. Come on.
Not
you,
right.
You have to give these people. And like you, and even what you're speaking to with Winners at War also speaks to that. But it's especially harmful. I'm not saying it comes from like a sinister place necessarily, but I mean, it is because I don't think that's necessarily it. I just think it's harmful when we think about the implications of like portraying a Black person that way, because that sticks to us, you know? And it's sad because, you know, I could go throw some rice in a fire and then that might erase everything else I've done in people's eyes, right? Or do like one thing that's a little bit off, and then that's what people define you by, rather than, you know, seeing you fully for your successes, your failures, the positives and the negatives. So there's a lot there.
And if I may, to that point, it could just be a blind spot of theirs. And I started trying to understand that when it's a bunch of, when the producers is like the White Boys Club, maybe telling a Black man's story or a Black woman's story or a gay man's story, maybe that is one of their blind spots. And so, we asked to kind of change that around too a little bit, so that there are more Black faces or Black psychologists or Black people in casting. Exactly. Or a Black executive producer, we, at the very least, then that can, those people might be able to help tell our stories a little bit, or stray from certain tropes, or as a castaway, like in my position on this island, not seeing any Black faces, behind the camera. Well, there were some of the camera crews were Black dudes, but like, not seeing some of the producers or like these storytellers, there's something that it does to you. And some people can rise above it, but it's better at least seeing someone that looks like you, that is out there. When you're in this crazy game, that is like, it's a lot. It's all the survivors, it's their goals, it's their dreams. They wanted to be out there so long. So let's free people from anything that can hinder them just going out there and playing their game. And so seeing, I think seeing a more diverse cast and also having a more diverse behind the scenes, crew will really help more people just go out there and play their games.
When you were talking a lot about representation, you're talking about kind of your experiences as a Black survivor player, winner. But I actually want to ask you about one of my favorite winners, one of my favorite Black winners. I know I'm not talking about Jeremy Collins, and maybe I'm using the term winner loosely, but Bryce Isaiah. I want to kind of bring him up because... Yes. You know, an icon. I always say to Bryson, like, you paved the way for me to like be on RHAP, where I have like two shows right now between Pod Friends and the Wrestling Rehab Up. And like, he's so iconic. And I love him so much, but I want to kind of ask you, even based on that, especially like from my well, number one, why do you put up with Bryce is the first question.
Great question. Still trying to figure that out.
Let's start there. Why do you put up with Bryce?
Okay. So man, where do I even start with Bryce?
Yeah.
I'll answer your question. Why do I put up with him? Because he is by far the funniest person I know. He is hilarious. I equate walking around with Bryce to walking around with a real life cartoon character, because he's larger than life. The things that come out of his mouth are ridiculous. I learned so much from him. I've always had gay friends, always, even when I didn't know they were gay. It, like my middle school best friend, when I moved school districts, and he moved school districts, we were best friends. He was a gay guy. My childhood best friend, I told you I went to like summer camp.
Yeah.
Like, he was a gay guy. I've always, at Morehouse, it's an all male school. There's a lot of gay men there. I've always had friends, and I've been comfortable around people of all persuasions, but you know, gay guys. And Bryce, I watched him on Survivor, and this was when I was a Survivor fan. I'm like, this guy is a little weird. I don't know if I knew he was a Philly guy, but then fast forward to my season, and I think he hit me up on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I don't even use Facebook. I don't use Facebook Messenger. He hit me up like, yo, let's link up. Ultimately, we linked up, and ever since, we've been like literally like best friends, like brothers. And a crazy story is, I met him well before Survivor, and I have someone in my family that suffers a mental illness, and that person called me and needed like, that person was institutionalized. Yeah. They called me, they needed like cigarettes and some sandwiches or something. And I went to the place, which is like, you know, a half hour from here. And when I walked in, this is like 10 years ago, 12 years ago. When I walked in, someone, a gay black dude, checked me in at this mental institution. I went in and I saw the person. I gave them what they needed. I gave them hugs and love. And I left. And then like after bonding with Bryce, becoming great friends with him, he was like, Wendell, do you know that I met you before? I was like, what are you talking about? He said, you came in to visit that person and I was the guy working the door in there. He said, I never forget a face and I know it was you. And I, when he said that, I was like, I do remember that person there. And then life brought us back around and together.
Wow.
And sadly, one of his brothers, his name is Bevan, he passed away.
Right.
And I never had a brother. I had lots of close friends, but now Bryce is like the closest thing to a brother that I have. And I think I kind of like stepped into that position as his big bro. So like, it's crazy how life brought us together a couple times, but right now I love watching him just thrive, live his authentic self, use his powerful voice, be hilarious, be ridiculous, say the most ridiculous things, have me speaking like I've never spoke before.
Yeah.
The language I now know, I guess it's like I can communicate in his language with him or with like any gay dude I see, I could turn it on and I'll let people know. Like there are these words that he says that I've now learned mean different things in the gay community.
And like what?
Like, have you heard of cruising?
Oh yeah. 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 Okay. What else?
Like, have you heard of the trade?
Yeah. Yeah. No, Bryce has talked a lot about trade on.
All right. Have you heard about this one? He's not going to like, have you heard about painting?
I can imagine.
We'll talk about that later. Anyway,
yeah. I was like, I don't know. People had like the TV MA rating to this podcast. I don't know.
So anyway, Bryce has like this lingo that I had no idea about. And also he taught me like, for example, when I was first getting to know Bryce and who he is as a gay black man in this country and just who he is, right? I went to I did something for like one of these show appearances where I met Honey Davenport. You know Honey Davenport?
Honey Davenport, RuPaul's
Drag Race, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like very comfortable around gay people. So I was like, Honey Davenport over there looking like a snack. I said something like that to and then she looked at me and said something like don't try it or something like that. I'm like, oh, maybe I should. But then I like snapped a photo with her. I sent it to Bryce. I'm like, yo, da da da. I've been able to learn so much about that. Yeah. Like just because he's a gay guy, he's not attracted to like any other kind of gay person. It's a certain, he has a type. And I guess this other kind of like, I've been able to learn so much about the LGBTQ community. To where I have like ally flags and other things just to like, I just want to show acceptance and people see me and Bryce and they're like, what is this friend? Like what brings you two together? And because especially in the Black community, they're even to this day, there's still homophobia and other things. And I think our friendship, and I know it's shown people just like that those friendships can exist. And I think it portrays the right thing, but it's also, it's from a genuine place. I love the guy to death. He's my brother. And I speak to him every single day. I see him at least once a week. So it's a beautiful friendship.
Yeah. And I'll even say, so texting with Bryce before this one, he, you know, one thing he mentioned to me just to kind of pass on to you is, and you know, he's talked, this is no surprise, I'm sure, because he's talked about this so many times, but he just mentioned how much he appreciates your friendship and your brotherhood. And you know, I know that you talked about how much you've grown and learned through him, but like, there's also the other side of that, everything that he's grown and learned from just being your close friend and overcoming a lot of phobias. I know Bryce talks about this a lot on the Purple Pants podcast, but like phobias that many of us, like Black queer people, might have of like Black straight men. And we could go into like homophobia in the Black community in a lot of communities, but specifically in the Black community in this context. And so there's a lot there, but I kind of want to ask, like, maybe to like button up the Bryce love a little bit. There's so much that people could learn from your friendship. And, you know, it's not all the time that we see like straight Black men and like queer Black men like as friends. Like, what do you think people are missing, and like what are some of the barriers that you see to like more friendships like that? Is there anything that you've kind of like picked up on in terms of that?
Sometimes, first of all, straight men need to understand that like all gay guys aren't trying to hit on you or get with you or anything like that. And I guess that is that's one maybe barrier. And I guess with this ultra hyper masculinity in the Black community, where people think that if they're seen with a gay person, then people might view them as a gay person. There's that also. These are things that just Bryce and I being friends, the way we are friends, we just try to live. We try to dispel those false thoughts based on just how we live and express our friendship to everybody. Mm-hmm. And I think Bryce has gotten messages about it, just saying like, hey, I appreciate you guys' friendship. I know I've gotten messages about it. And but yeah, there are those things in the Black community that kind of, you know, I don't know. And there's a lot in the community that doesn't, it's this hyper masculinity that kind of gets in the way. And I think that the country's going in a direction where a better direction, where there can be more friendships.
Yeah. And
because, like I said, I've learned so much from Bryce, maybe more than he's learned from me. I know that I help him out, and I know that I try to amplify his voice. But man, the things I've learned from him on a daily basis, and even regarding like compassion and just and understanding people more and listening, being a better listener, because on a daily basis, I'm trying to understand more about Bryce and understand where he's coming from, because the way we grew up was different. So then the things that I learn from my best friend, Bryce, I learned that people come with different baggage, might not be the right word, but people, like, when they meet you, their paths brought you there, but you don't know what happened in that path that might inform different decisions of them, of theirs going forward. So if I say or do something around Bryce and he clams up, and he doesn't talk to me for 2 days, in my head, I'm like, why is this fool not talking to me? Like, communicate, talk to me. What's up? What's wrong?
Yeah.
He might, whatever his path brought him to where he is, might make him respond to someone like me by clamming up now.
Mm-hmm.
So then there's just so much. There's a lot about people that I learned from Bryce.
Yeah. And I think it's powerful too, that even just like through the Purple Pants podcast, number one, one thing I'll say is that I love whenever Bryce, jokingly, lovingly drags you, because always. I remember like the first time I met you, which was completely coincidental, running into you on the corner of 21st and K here in DC. Yes. And I had no clue that you would be like putting up posters at the proper 21K, I believe, where Bryce Wynn Presents was that day. Like, I even remember, I don't know what I said, but I remember I was like, oh yeah, it's Wendell. Okay. Hey, hi Wendell. Oh, hey. Bryce! Yeah. So that, I love that for you guys too. And I love like the fact that it's on all of your friendship is out there for people to like keep up with and learn from. And Bryce's voice is out there, like through the Purple Pants podcast, of course, but kind of like shifting more to like where you are now, obviously, you know, Purple Pants podcast, Beav Unlimited, there's HGTV. There's so much that you're up to now. I have to give a shout out there. You were on Survivor Philly, which was iconic. I think maybe that's your most popular appearance. Probably. Shout out to Alex Gardner, but I kind of want to like, get to something, you know, kind of like wrapping up your story, because we could probably be here for hours, like talking through the different elements of it. But, you know, something that I've seen in your story is just like this drive and this determination and like never settling for less or for not being capable. Like, do you have advice for people who are hearing from you on these things? Because you're sharing like, you're sharing the dedication you have. You're sharing the learning that you've done, the ways that you've grown. Like, do you have advice for people who want to kind of like bring that same energy into their world, into their lives of like, I'm unstoppable, which is like a lot of what I think you kind of have not only taught what your words say, but like you just looking at you like, damn. Wendell's a great example of someone who can't be stopped. And more of us want that energy.
Yeah, like I said, with winning Survivor and being like one of this small class of winners, like, and that kind of skewing my first perception of Survivor. Yeah. Oh, Survivor's all great. They're only, you know, like, I recognize that I'm in kind of a privileged position first. I recognize that, you know, I came from a great family. I still have two parents. Mm-hmm. I went to great schools. I was able to live my dream on Survivor. And so I might have a skewed perception of the world, even that if there's something that you see, if you stick to it, like if you keep on pushing the right buttons, if you have a goal, you can achieve it, but you got to stick to it. Mm-hmm. I have like 100 books on my bookshelf that give those kinds of words and that kind of advice. That's like, if you stick to something, there are ways to do it by like being laser focused on a goal. And there's a book called The One Thing where it's like, you pick one thing and you get to that for that one thing that you want to do in a year. How do you do it? What gets you there in 6 months, or what gets you there in 1 month? What gets you there in one week, and start with that 1 week. And then get to that 1 month, and then get to that 6 months. Like, I've surrounded myself with things that tell me, like reinforcers that say, you know what, these are how you accomplish your goals. But also, I've lived a life that has kind of shown me that if you have that goal, even if you don't accomplish it at first, I didn't get into Penn undergrad, you know?
Yeah.
I did my thing at Morehouse. I was able to get into Penn Law. I didn't get on Survivor my first 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in LA for a small amount of time. I drove like 2 hours out to go to a live casting call, and I thought I killed it. I didn't get on back then. On YouTube is my video of me applying when I'm sitting in the judge's chair, in the courtroom. I got the low cut. I got a tie on, and I'm saying like, you know, I didn't get on then. But I didn't give up. And so I try to tell people to have a goal and not give up on that goal. The people coming off the show and the people going on the show, I try to tell them, no matter how you're portrayed on the show, It's what you want, whatever you want to create after that show is what you can do. And I use Bryce as an example. I use myself as an example. Some people come off and they're upset about their portrayal, and they might be rightfully so. But
right.
What I say is, it doesn't matter how you were portrayed. It, what matters is your how you interact with people on a daily basis. The people that meet you that will ultimately inevitably recognize you on the street, they become ambassadors of yours. They become people that speak praises of you. So be friendly to them. And after coming off of the show, think about whatever you want to do and have that as your goal and do it. And that's what what I've been blessed to be able to do with a lot of luck. But like getting on HGTV, my goodness, as a builder, that's what as someone that builds and designs furniture, that's what I wanted to do. And of course I went on Ghost Island wanting to build everything I could on that island, so maybe someone would see me out there. And that's what happened.
But I have to ask, like, what is it that you want to, like, you're talking about building. There's so much there. We're kind of getting to the end. I have a couple more, two more questions. One of them, though, is like, what is it that you want to manifest in the world? We're talking about goals, Wendell. So we're here. The people are listening. What's your next big goal? Because you've crushed a lot of those goals that you've had. What's next on your journey? Or what do you want to, like, I'm almost picturing some stars and some magical, I'm not going to add sound effects, but like some magical sound effects in there. Like what is it? What's coming up next? What do you want to come up next for you, I should say?
All right. I appreciate that question. I'm a manifester.
Speak it into existence.
I'm a journaler. I try to put things out into the universe. And I've said this I said I wanted to be on HGTV for a very long time. And I've said what I'm going to say next many times. I want to be one of their guys. I want to be one of their faces. I've been, the last show we shot was my sixth show with them since the pandemic. A lot of them have been like little appearances, little co-hosts for one hour, Hot Mess House. I had a whole season. That was my first whole season. And that was a blessing. Yeah. I really, really, all the execs, all the production company, everyone that has ever production companies, anyone in the HGTV world that has met me knows that like, I love that network and I want to be one of their go-to guys. So whatever that means, I mean, right now, like I said, they've called me six times now and that's great, but I see some real faces that are very recognizable on that network. I want to be one of their real faces. And, one other thing, I've been recognized one single time from HGTV. One time. I'm recognized a lot for Survivor.
Yeah.
But I want to be one of their guys to where I can be recognized for HGTV. Like, oh my gosh, you're that guy from that show on HGTV.
Look, I hope that for you. Cause like the thing is, if I went on Twitter now and searched for a GIF of you dancing on HGTV, like maybe that's not in Twitter's go-tos, but that was a moment. And those, I don't know. I don't know if it was more than one time, but I like the spice, the energy that you bring. I feel like HGTV needs more of it. All I'm asking though is like, if you need anyone to like shine your shoes on the show or like, you know, maybe you need like, I don't know. Like, I'm just saying, I'm here. You could call me, you hit me up. But you know, one last question I really want to ask is just about your story and kind of like wrapping it up is like, if your life were a book or a documentary, Wendell, what would the title be? And why?
Okay. I like that question a lot. What I really, really like to do is take people that are friends of mine and just give them a little more encouragement or like say something that kind of gets them going. I like trying to motivate people. And so I think if I were to have a book, and I've written little chapters here and there. I have an outline of if I were to have written a book on myself, I have like an outline. I also have a children's book that I wrote in my head on Winners at War. Wow. Then I transcribed it when I got off the show. So I have that also, which I'd love to get out there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a pretty dope book about like many cultures coming together to achieve something great. So
we'll get that out there sooner or later.
We'll get it out there
sooner. Yeah.
Sooner.
Yeah.
But if I had a book that I could publish about my life, it would be motivational, and I'd probably call it Planting Seeds, because I like to try to like plant motivational seeds in people that gets them to do great things. And even regarding the diversity initiative, before the CBS diversity initiative, there'd be a small handful of Black folks and BIPOC folks coming out. There'd be small classes coming out every season, right? One or two people here and there.
Right.
I was able to meet the cookout at Hearts of Reality, and mm-hmm. I'm like, this is beautiful. And this is one season. And if I could do something little in these people that encourages them to then do something little in the next class or the next classes of mm-hmm. Survivor, BIPOC, and Big Brother BIPOC, then man, like if we all just plant these little seeds in these people, who knows what can blossom. So my book would be entitled Planting Seeds, and it would be motivational and about just the effect that inspiring one or two people could do to many more people via some sort of butterfly effect.
Damn. This is all so deep. And you know what? I think like one thing I'm excited about, I'm not even going to try to like build on that, add to that. That's so, you've given us so much in this time and I just want to thank you for this, Wendell. And you know what? The good news is, people are hearing you now. They could meet you at Bryce and Wen Presents, yep. which is a great time. Not only connecting with like you and Bryce and other Survivor players and some other people in this reality TV world, but also meeting other fans, meeting some podcasters. I will probably be there. If you don't want to meet me, well then like, you can avoid me, but like, it's all good, you know, all love. But you know what? I think like you are creating such a space for yourself in this world and in the in not only this Survivor adjacent community, but just like carving out a space that other people don't occupy. And I think that that's really powerful and motivational. And so I don't know, I just want to kind of give you the space for any final words to close us out.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you very, very much for having me on. Like I said, I view this as a safe space. Yeah. I think that your voice is a powerful voice, as is Bryce's, and mm-hmm. there's something to you and this podcast. So thank you for having me on. Can't wait to see you again soon.
Yeah.
And Bryce and Wen Presents, what is it? The 42 premiere mm-hmm. is next week, but also we will be coming to DC this season. We will be... Uh-huh. Maybe going elsewhere, maybe going to the Midwest, maybe going to the left coast.
Whoa.
So we got a lot coming this season. We have big plans. And I just appreciate you giving me the time to just ramble on for so long.
Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning into this week's episode, the season finale of Pod Friends. Again, I would encourage you to follow Pod Friends at Hey Pod Friends. Subscribe to Pod Friends, robhaswebsite.com/podfriendsfeed. There are other links in the description for where you can become a patron, where you can email me, all the things. It's all there. So check out those show notes. And again, just big thanks to Rob's sister, Nino, for the opportunity. Thank you to Scott St. Pierre, Hannah Lidsky, Sam Moore, Tricky Rice, Chelsea Lesser, just the whole team at RHAP who's making this possible. And if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me podfriends@robhiswebsite.com. But you're all amazing. So thankful for you. And one last time for this first season, I just want to thank you for being a pod friend.